beat to put it into context. I shuffled his features around in my head like a puzzle, trying to place them. He stepped into the room, and instantly I recognized his shaggy hair and glowing green eyes. It was the boy who'd never told me his name, the one who'd saved my life back at the pit. "You!" I exclaimed, my bald fists unballing and my spine relaxing. For the first time in, literally, I don't know how long, I let myself entertain the thought of hope. He had saved me once. Was he here to save me again? The boy just put a finger to his lips and waved toward the window. That's when I noticed the crows for the first time. There were several of them, all perched on the window ledge on the other side of the glass, peering in. One of the birds cocked its head. The thing had ears, human ears, grafted awkwardly to either side of its head. A second passed, and the crow next to the first one cawed loudly, staring at me. It blinked once, twice, with big human eyelids. I cried out in frightened surprise, but the boy rapped against the glass a few times, and they disappeared into the night. "You have to watch out for them," he explained. "They're called overhears. The Scarecrow makes them in his lab. They're spies, but the good part is that they're pretty stupid. It's ironic, really. The one thing he hasn't figured out is how to give them brains. They can see you and hear you, but they're too dumb to understand anything, so they're not so good at reporting any of it back. If you're careful around them, they're mostly harmless. Another one of his failed experiments." "Who are you?" I asked. Here he was, acting like just waltzing in here was no big deal, and he wasn't making any moves to save me. Maybe I shouldn't trust him. "Sorry, I guess I never introduced myself. I'm Pete," he said. "You don't have to whisper now that they're gone, though." Pete? The name sounded too ordinary for him. Anyway, while it was useful to finally know his name, it wasn't really what I'd been asking. I wanted answers. "No," I said it firmly, placing a stiff period carefully at the end of the word. "Who are you?" meaning, "Why are you here?" meaning, "What do you want with me?" meaning, "How did you get in here?" meaning, "Who the fuck are you?" Without meaning to, I was screaming. I hoped the overhears were long gone by now. Pete rolled onto his heels, taken aback by my outburst, but he answered my questions calmly. "I'm Pete," he said again. "I'm here because I know that you can go crazy down here with no one to talk to, and I don't want you to go crazy. So I lifted a key. I work in the palace." Pete glanced nervously over at Star, who glared at him from underneath the bed. She didn't trust him either. "I'm here to keep you company. For as long as I can, at least." Nothing about this story made any sense. How had he found me at the exact moment I'd landed in Oz? How had he found out I was down here? If I was in a magicked prison cell with no door, how had he just lifted a key? He was definitely not telling me everything. Which led me to my next question. Was he really on my side? "You work in the palace?" "I'm a gardener." "So you work for her, then?" He might as well have been the window for all the good he did me. Simply another thing to torture me with false hope. Unless he wasn't here to give me hope at all. "I'm just a gardener," he said. "I work for the head gardener. The head gardener works for the royal steward. I've never spoken to Dorothy." He was lying. There was no question in my mind. His eyes were too big and luminous. You couldn't hide anything behind eyes like those. And yet, he had already saved me once. Why would he have done that if he was working for Dorothy? Pete slumped against the wall. I hadn't moved from my defensive position in the corner. Should I go? He asked. He looked, in that moment, just like a little kid. I really didn't mean to upset you. I thought it would help. If you go, I said, I'll kill you! I only said it because I was angry, but it gave me an idea. Without warning, I lunged for him and grabbed him by the throat before he could react. I shoved my knee into his groin. Pete's mouth widened into a perfect O of shock. I didn't think I would be able to take him in a fight, but he might not know that. If I scared him enough, maybe he would think I was more dangerous than I really was. It worked, I think. At least he didn't resist. Give me the key, I said. You can take it if that's what you want, he said. I'll give it to you, but it won't do you much good. It's not just the lock that's keeping you down here. The moment the cell's unoccupied, all the alarms will sound. They'll know you're gone. They'll catch you before you can make it 3 feet, and they'll throw you right back in here. That's if you're lucky. More likely, they'll skip the trial and just send you straight to the Scarecrow. Trust me, if you think this is bad, that's worse. I cocked my head. I thought about loosening my grip on his neck. Instead, I tightened it and nudged my knee forward an inch. He grimaced, but didn't say anything. If I take the key and leave you here in my place, the cell won't be unoccupied. No alarms, then. At that, Pete raised his eyebrows in surprise. Maybe he hadn't expected me to be desperate enough to trade my freedom for his. Honestly, I was a little surprised myself. Still, that was all the reaction I got. You could, he said calmly, if that's the way you want to play it. It still wouldn't do you any good. We're deep underground here, and the entrances to the dungeons are always guarded. You might get out of the cell, but you still have to get past the guards. It's worth the risk. Maybe. Maybe not. He was right, of course. I felt defeat seeping in through every pore. It was useless. I dropped my hold on him and walked over to my so-called bed, where I perched myself on the edge and buried my face in my hands. Hey, he said. I felt his hand on my shoulder and looked up to see him standing over me. If it means anything to you, I've been trying to think of a way to get you out of here. I can't find one. You're too important to Dorothy. It's a miracle I managed to get the key and sneak down here at all. But I'll find a way, okay? I still have a few tricks up my sleeve. Why? I asked, my eyes suddenly pooling with tears. Why are you trying to help me? He flipped his palms to the ceiling as if to say, Why not? Because it's the right thing. He sat next to me on the bed, keeping a safe distance between us. I rolled my eyes. No one does anything because it's the right thing, I said. You do. I do? Maybe that was true. But even if it was, how would he know it? We'd known each other for all of 20 minutes total. You do, Pete said, this time with emphasis. Except when you threatened to kill me, that is. I had to laugh at that. But I didn't actually kill you, so it doesn't count. Seriously, he said. Everyone in the palace has been whispering about Dorothy's latest prisoner. I knew it had to be you. The girl I rescued from the tin farm. Ever since I saw you, I just had a feeling. I feel responsible for you. Only then did it occur to me that this was the first time I'd ever had a boy in my bed. The circumstances were less than ideal. Not that it mattered at a time like this. I was trapped in a cell, in a strange kingdom, facing an inevitable sentence of a fate worse than death. It wasn't the moment to be shopping for a boyfriend. "How did you know I would be there?" I asked. "When my trailer crashed by the pit. If you work all the way over here in the palace, how did you know I was there? I mean, you got there right in the nick of time. Any later, and I'd have fallen in."
"I just had a feeling," he said, shifting in his seat. I don't know. It was just like someone was calling me there. So I went.
Part of me didn't care that he was obviously still lying.
He'd been right.
After all the hours locked away in here, all alone, it really did help just to have him sitting next to me. Just to hear another human voice. To be able to ask a question and get an answer back. Even if it wasn't the right answer. Then that faraway, distracted look crossed his face again. The same look I'd seen him get the day I met him, just before he left me. It was the look of someone trying to place a distant tune that only he could hear. His body seemed to flicker in and out, to grow hazy around the edges. But it was so faint, I couldn't be sure it wasn't my imagination. It reminded me of the hologram of Ozma we'd seen on the road. He stood up abruptly. This time, I thought I knew what was coming.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I have to go."
"Why?" I asked.
"I'm sorry," he said again. "I'll try to help you if I can."
Then, before I could protest, before I could even stand to say goodbye, he had pulled a big brass key from the pocket of his loose white gardener's pants. He walked across the cell in three quick strides and plunged it into a space in the wall where there was no keyhole. The stone rippled around it like he'd just dropped a pebble in a pond. The door appeared. He pushed it open.
"Pete,"
I said. My voice cracked unexpectedly as I said it. I just wanted him to look at me. He didn't. He stepped out, the door sealed up, and I was alone again. Chapter 11. After that, I really lost track of time. I slept, I sat, I slept some more, and forced down the disgusting bowls of porridge that would now and then, without warning, materialize on the ever-pristine floor of my prison. I looked out the enchanted evil window. Sometimes it was night, and sometimes it was day. When the moon was out, I tried to judge the passage of time by its phases, but it was no use. It would be full one moment, and a thin thumbnail crescent the next. And then, when I turned away and looked for it again, gone entirely. I wasted about 15 minutes trying to play hide-and-seek with Star, but it was pointless. There was no place to hide except under the bed, and anyway, only Star was small enough to fit down there. With nothing to do except think, my mind kept returning to my mother. I was ashamed of myself for how little I'd thought about her since I'd come to Oz, but now I couldn't stop wondering whether she had made it through the tornado, about whether she was searching for me, or whether she was laid up somewhere, drunk or stoned or whatever else. If there was even a chance she was out there, looking for me, or hoping I'd make it home okay, then I couldn't give up. I'd made a promise to myself that I'd do anything to help Ollie and his family, thinking that my mother was beyond my help. But now I realized that no matter how far away my mother was, no matter how far gone she might be, I would always feel a sense of obligation to her. Then again, it's not like I was in much of a position to help anyone right now. Honestly,
I could use a little help myself.
After 2 or 3 days, I think, but who knew, Pete came to me again.
I don't have long, he said, stepping through the door. His voice was strained with uncharacteristic panic.
Your trial is tomorrow, he said. The news is all over the palace.
I sat up in bed with a start. I'd been down here so long now that I'd nearly forgotten I had a trial coming up at all. The wild look in Pete's eyes reminded me that, as bad as things were, they could still get worse.
What exactly does a trial entail? I asked, still holding out some irrational hope that maybe I could be exonerated.
He shook his head and looked down at his hands.
Just tell me, I said. Maybe there's some trick to it. Things like that always work in fairy tales.
Do you honestly think this is a fairy tale? Pete asked.
Just tell me what to expect.
He sighed, finally relenting.
Her Royal Highness's Kangaroo Court.
It's a total joke, he said. I think the only reason she bothers with trials at all is because she likes wearing the big white wig. Once you go to trial, you're already as good as guilty. I don't think there's ever been a not guilty verdict as long as the court's been in existence.
In the face of my impending fate worse than death sentence, I found that I was surprisingly calm. Maybe it just didn't seem real.
So what do I do? I asked. Pete looked at his hands. He tousled his hair and then looked back at me in sheepish apology.
We could make a break for it, he said. Maybe with 2 of us we could fight our way past the guards.
We both knew what a dumb idea it was.
That will just get us both killed, I said. What's the point of that?
Yeah, he said. I know.
What about magic? I mean, this is Oz, right? Isn't there some spell that would work? It doesn't even have to be a good one.
He shook his head. I never learned to do magic, he said. I was never good at it, and no one ever thought it was important for a gardener to learn, especially once Dorothy made it illegal for anyone except her and her friends to practice it. I wouldn't even be able to cast a simple extinguishing spell without it setting off the magical alarms and going on trial myself.
What about someone else? Do you know anyone who would give you, like, some kind of mystical trinket or something? I mean, I don't know.
I thought of that. I talked to every illegal practitioner I could think of, and none of them will help. It's too risky. Anyway, I doubt anything like that would work down here. There are anti-magic wards everywhere in the dungeons. You'd have to be really powerful to break through them, like Glinda powerful.
Some magic shoes would really come in handy right about now, huh? I said.
Seriously.
Maybe... He stopped himself. Maybe what?
It's nothing. It's just... There might be one more person who...
Who?
I asked eagerly.
No, he said. It would never...
Who?
He spoke with finality this time.
No. It won't ever work.
Please, I said. Whatever you can do, please just try.
Pete nodded.
Okay, he said.
I'll ask. But it's a long shot. It's the longest shot.
We were both quiet. I scraped my nails absently along the stone walls next to my bed, trying to make a mark. Any mark. It was like with Indigo's tattoos. We all had our ways of saying, I was here.
Listen, Pete said.
Amy.
I jerked my head up.
Yeah?
He pulled something out of his pocket and stepped over to me. It's not much, but maybe you can do something with this.
From out of his pocket, he drew a small kitchen knife and pressed it into my hand. He was right. It wasn't much. But it was something. And he was giving it to me. Thank you, I said. I leaned up to his face and kissed him solemnly on the cheek. I'm sorry I can't do more. I will make it, I said firmly. At this point, I didn't really feel like I had any choice but to keep believing that. Then I remembered one more thing. Something important. Wait, I said, and I ducked under the bed to retrieve Star. I'd hated her from the moment my mother brought her home. I'd hated the responsibility of taking care of something that I never asked for, and I'd hated the way my mother seemed to care more about a rodent than she did about me. Or she had cared about her until she'd stopped caring. Star and I were kind of in the same boat that way. An unexpected well of emotion opened up somewhere behind my ribs. She had been a faithful companion since I'd gotten here. She was the last thing I had left to connect me to where I came from. And she had been a good friend, even if she couldn't talk. I cupped her furry body in my palms and gave her one last kiss on the forehead. Take her for me, I said. Keep her safe for me. I had hated her, and now didn't want to let her go. Star was not so sentimental. She crawled from my hands and into Pete's without looking back at me. Great, he said. Just what I've always wanted. A rat. I smiled. Just do it. He lifted her up to his face and let her lick him. Fine, I'll take her, he said. But I'm not keeping her forever. Just until you're safe and you can take her back. He dropped her into the breast pocket of his shirt, and she squealed happily. Go, I said, giving him permission so he wouldn't have to ask. I don't, he said. Just go. I'll be okay. But if you know anyone who owes you a miracle... I'll see what I can do, Pete said. He placed his key in the wall. The door opened. I watched him go. Chapter 12. I was ready for them when they came for me the next day. I had paced my cell all night making plans, none of them very good. If I was going down, I was going to do it kicking and screaming, not to mention biting, clawing, and hair-pulling. And of course, stabbing. My knife, tiny as it was, never left my hand. I heard them coming long before they reached me. The Tin Woodman and his metal men made a lot of noise descending all those flights of marble stairs. As they creaked toward me, I crouched in the corner nearest to where I knew the door would appear, and waited. I didn't really know what I was going to do when they got here, but tackling the Tin Woodman as soon as the door opened and then making a break for it would be a start. It wasn't the best idea I'd ever had, but at least it was something. Thunk, crash, creak, thunk. My heart began to pound. It was do-or-die time. I was so focused on where the door was about to appear and what I would do when it did that I didn't even notice when the room began to fill with hazy purple smoke until it was so thick I couldn't see a thing. When it had cleared away, an ancient-looking woman was standing in front of me. Her nose was big and crooked and bulbous with a big, hairy wart on the very tip. Purple rags barely covered her sagging, wrinkled flesh. And to top it off, she wore a hat. A black one, so weathered it was almost gray, its point standing at attention. A witch? I thought. She looked impossibly old. Her face one big wrinkle with eyes that were coal black and seemed to go on forever. When I looked into them, I somehow knew in one glance that she was as old as Oz itself. A strong, cold breeze hit me in the face. I stepped back. I didn't know whether I was supposed to be frightened or happy. Mostly, I was just confused. "Who are you?" I asked. I could hear the footsteps of the Tin Woodman getting louder. "How did you get in here?"
"I'm Mombi," she said in a scratchy voice. "And how do you think I got here?"
"What are you, then?" I asked. She gave me a sly wink.
"Another question that you already know the answer to. But I'll give you a hint anyway. I'm the wicked kind. Now, are you coming with me or not?"
I was happy she wasn't the Tin Woodman, but, like Pete, I had no idea who this person was. I wasn't going to just run away with her right off the bat.
"Well?" she asked impatiently, tapping her pointy toes against the floor as I stared at her. "They're almost here. I can get you out of here, but you have to make up your mind quick. Will you join me? Yes or no?"
Yes or no. This was the kind of thing you read about in fairy tales. What she meant was that if I wanted her help, I would have to agree to something. She just wasn't going to bother telling me what until it was too late. Thunk. Stomp. Thunk. Squeak. "What's the catch?" I asked. "I'm not giving you my firstborn, if that's what you want."
"Oh," she said, "that won't be necessary. The secondborn will do."
Seeing me blanch, she let out a long, hearty cackle.
"You're smart," she said. "I suppose you're right to ask. There's always a catch with us wicked witches. But I don't care much for babies. I've already had a few bad experiences with them, if you want the truth. No, you can keep your disgusting spawn. Don't see how you'll manage to get any children at all if you stay here, though. Dorothy'll have you dead before sundown."
We heard the key begin to turn in the lock outside. Mombi sighed as the door in the wall began to appear.
"Girls your age," she said, shaking her head, "always takes you forever to get out of the house. Now we're going to have to fight."
She backed up into the corner and squeezed her body so tightly against the wall that it almost looked like she was sinking right into it.
"At least I see you have a knife already."
She nodded to my hand, where I was clutching my weapon so hard that I thought I might be starting to lose circulation.
"Let me just give it a tiny little enchantment to make it more useful."
She wiggled her pinky and thumb in my direction and clicked her tongue a few times. When I held my knife in front of me, I saw that it was pulsing with a purple glow. If this was going to make it more useful, it was just in time. The door swung open, and the Tin Woodman stepped into the room.
"Amy Gum," he announced, "it's time to face your judgment."
It took him a beat to realize that I wasn't alone.
"Guards," he shouted, "seize the girl and the witch."
He fanned the blades of his hand out in front of him as he lunged for my new ally, his crew rushing into the cell behind him. Swordarm was in front of me, advancing with sword outstretched, backing me into a corner. I stepped out of her way, ducked under her, and thrust my kitchen knife toward her chest just as she pivoted to face me. I missed, but I was surprised at how close I'd come, at how the weight and heft of the knife felt so natural. Suddenly, I knew exactly when to thrust and when to parry, when to go high and when to go low and when to twist away. I felt like I could do some real damage with this thing. So I sliced and diced and feinted as the tin soldiers all scrambled to grab me.
A line of bright red blossomed across Sword Arm's cheek as I connected. I pulled back at the sight of it, but the knife urged me forward again. I gave the head on the bicycle 2 flat tires in no time, sending him sprawling onto his side on the floor, where he struggled to pull himself upright with his weird handlebar arms. When the one with the panel covering his mouth, the one who had killed Indigo, grabbed my arm and twisted it behind my back, I pushed against him with my free arm and wiggled loose. He put out his arms in an almost shrug, offering himself up for another attempt, like he was daring me to fail at checking him again. Then he charged at me, this time crouching low to deliver some kind of deadly headbutt. I ducked out of the way at the last moment, but he spun quickly around and caught me in the back, slamming me to the ground. I lay motionless for a second, the wind knocked out of me. He nudged me with his foot, roughly rolling me over. Grabbing me by the neck, he hauled me to my feet and pulled me close to him. So close that I could tell by his eyes, if not his mouth panel, that he was smirking. I was over this. I had been through too much. I had seen too much. I had been angry before, at Madison, at my mom, but I had never felt anything like this. I could feel myself seize up, every muscle contracting at once, gripped by what Dorothy had done to Indigo, by what she had planned for me. But instead of stuffing it down or blurting out something stupid, I struck. I jabbed the blade of Mombi's knife into the thing's eye socket. It was for Indigo. It was for me, too. Blood spurted everywhere as he slumped against the wall and collapsed. I looked down at the knife, at the Rorschach pattern of blood splattered on the ground. I wanted to believe it was the knife that had done that, not me, but I wasn't so sure. I felt sick to my stomach, still not quite believing it, but Sword Arm was on me again, and she was mad. In one swift motion, she knocked my blade from my grip, and it went clattering to the ground. I was now defenseless as she shoved me up against the wall. I punched with my fist, but the hard metal of her arm hurt me more than my punches hurt her, and I screamed through clenched teeth. She raised the shiny blade of her deadly arm over her head, and I braced myself. "Mombi!" I yelled. Without dropping her own attack on the Tin Woodman, Mombi reached her free hand into her robes again and pulled out what looked like a ball of purple yarn. She hurled it in my direction, and as it looped through the air, it began to unspool, its threads becoming indistinct and unfocused, twisted and curling in 100 different directions. When the ball hit Sword Arm, it instantly began to wrap itself around her, covering her in sticky purple cobwebs. She struggled against it, but her weapon was stuck in midair. Mombi's magic had bought me some time.
"I can hold them for a few seconds, Amy!" Mombi shrieked from the other side of the room. "Now will you join us or not?"
I knew I had no other choice.
"Done!" I cried.
Mombi reached out a hand. I dove across the room for it and grabbed on tight. As I touched her, the purple rags began to billow out from around her body. The rags curled around the two of us, enveloping us both in a cocoon as the Tin Woodman and his henchmen faded away, along with the room itself. I was smoke now, too.
"Welcome to the Revolutionary Order of the Wicked, Amy," Mombi hissed as we disappeared.
Chapter 13. Mombi let go of my hand as we materialized someplace dark. Someplace so dark I couldn't see my hands. But even without being able to see, I could still feel the coldness of the knife in my clenched palm. The darkness washed over me. a darkness like I'd never experienced before. "Where?" I started, and then trailed off, feeling a dizzying, spiraling sense of panic. What had I gotten myself into? My breathing was getting shallower and shallower, when a bright spark appeared in the blackness, just inches from my face. When my eyes focused in on it, I saw a tiny, glowing spider crawling through the air. As it moved in a zigzagging spiral, Mombi's body slowly faded into view next to me. I looked down at myself and saw that I was now illuminated too. The light was confined to our bodies, though. Everything around us remained as dark as ever. Where are we? I asked the witch, the words catching in my throat. What had I gotten myself into?
You'll know in good time, my dear, she said, wiggling her eyebrows. There's a lot for us to talk about, and I could use a nice long nap. All that teleportation will take the wind right out of an old girl like me. I'm sure you agree.
It wasn't until she said it that I realized I was exhausted, too. My legs were shaky, every bit of my body was sore, and my arm was throbbing with pain. I felt like I could sleep for 1,000 years. Then I started to remember what had happened, and my knees began to buckle in on themselves as the memories washed over me. The escape, the fight, the squishy, sick feeling of my knife burying itself in my foe's eye socket, and the thick geyser of blood that had come squirting out. It couldn't have been me. It felt more like something I had seen on TV than something that had actually happened to me. I would never have done that. I couldn't have. The girl who fought Sword Arm to a standstill had known what she was doing. I'd never hurt another person in my whole life. Well, not with my fists, at least. I felt the knife in my hand. It felt good. It felt like it was part of me. Suddenly I understood. It was the knife, right? I asked Mombi. It's magic. It was telling me what to do. Mombi swatted the question away.
Pish-tosh, she said. The knife's enchanted, certainly. It will whisper in your ear a little bit, tell you where to move, teach you a few tricks. But it can't make something out of nothing. It can't help you if you don't have it in you somewhere.
Her mouth spread into a wide grin, revealing a jammed-together row of rotting brown teeth.
Good thing you did, she said.
From the way she said it, I knew she meant it as a compliment, and I felt a twisted sense of pride rising in my chest. I tried to shove it back down. The fact that I had what it took to stab someone's eyes out was nothing to be proud of. No, I corrected myself, not someone, something. And that thing had been helping the Tin Woodman. That thing had been responsible for killing Indigo. I had nothing to feel guilty about. Mombi winked at me as if she knew exactly what I had been thinking. She reached out and wrapped her knotted, spindly hands around my closed fist.
Now, she said, you won't be needing that for a bit.
No, I said more angrily than I meant to, squeezing hard as she tried to pry my fingers open. The knife was mine. I didn't want to give it back. It could keep me safe. Mombi clucked her tongue, but didn't really seem to care.
See, that's the spirit. We'll make a wicked one out of you yet, now won't we?
I tried to pull my hand away, but she held it tight.
Don't worry. You'll have more weapons than you know what to do with soon enough. But in the meantime...
Mombi mumbled a few words under her breath, and I felt my fingers unlocking against my will. She took the knife and tucked it into her cloak.
That a girl, she said. Don't you worry about a thing. You're here now and safe. And you're free. Then she chuckled at something. Well, sort of, she said before letting out an uproarious cackle. Her laughter was still echoing around me as her body began to curl in on itself, like she was turning herself inside out. Then she was gone, and everything was dark again. Free. But was I? In some ways, it felt like I had traded one prison for another. We'll make a wicked one out of you yet. What had I gotten myself into? I stood there, waiting for my eyes to adjust, but they didn't. Maybe it wasn't even dark at all. Maybe it was just like outer space, where it's only dark because there's nothing to see. I was alone. I had been lonely a lot in my life, enough to know that there are different kinds of lonely. There's the lonely I had felt at school, surrounded by people who only paid attention to me long enough to remind me that they didn't like me. There was the lonely I felt when I was with my mother, which was different from the lonely that I felt when I watched her leaving just before the tornado hit, and different from the lonely that I felt when my trailer was being whisked away from everything I'd ever known. Then there was the bottomless loneliness that I'd felt in Dorothy's sick white dungeon. The kind of loneliness that had made me feel like I was running through an endless maze. Standing there in the dark, it was like all those alones had just been tiny, interlocking pieces of a picture so big that you could only see the whole thing from a mile away. Now it was clear. I had nothing except myself. No matter what happened, it would always be that way. And yet, I took a step forward and was surprised to feel solid ground underneath my feet. I took another. I stumbled on something and caught myself before I hit the ground. I was just about to move forward again when I heard a voice echoing all around me. It belonged to a woman, and it was kind and gentle and strangely familiar. I think you're starting to understand, she said. It will take a while, but you're getting there. I stopped in my tracks and jerked my head up. Who's there? I called out to the emptiness. What do you want from me? Instead of an answer, I heard the sound of fingers snapping. Just like that, the world returned to me. It was less like a light being turned on, and more a blindness being suddenly lifted. I was standing in a huge cave, the rocky walls pulsing eerily with a dim purple phosphorescence. High above my head, clusters of stalactites dangled perilously from the rocky ceiling. In the center of the cavern, a massive tree loomed, its trunk as thick around as five people, overgrown with vines and moss and tiny flowers. Hundreds of limbs curled upward until they merged with the rock formations on the ceiling. A tangle of roots covered the ground before disappearing into the walls. The longer I looked at the tree, the more I couldn't decide where it ended and the cave began. Why does there have to be a beginning and an ending? The voice asked. If you ask me, it's all middle. I spun around, trying to figure out where it was coming from, and saw nothing. Who are you? And from out of the tree, a squat, round old woman in a shapeless white dress and a pointy white hat emerged like she was walking through an open door. Except there was no door. There was no opening in the tree at all. People have called me lots of things over the years, the woman said. It happens when you get old. But you can call me Grandma Gert. She brushed a stray flower from her silvery white cloud of hair.
Her face was old and wrinkled, but it was nothing like Mombi's. It was round and kind, and so chubby that she had at least 3 chins, maybe 4. Her eyes twinkled as she smiled at me. Grandma Gert. I liked the sound of that. There was something about her that I trusted. It was all so strange. I should have been afraid, or angry, or at least startled or confused. I felt none of those things. When Gert reached out for my hand, I let her take it and clasp it between her own, squeezing tenderly. And I realized what I did feel. It was a warm sense of peacefulness, starting in my chest and spreading through my body.
"Welcome home, dear," she said.
"Home?" The word startled me, and when I repeated it, it caught in the back of my throat. I had no idea where I was, except that it was about as far away from home as I could possibly get. And yet,
"You're a long way from Kansas, I know," she said. "But there's more than one kind of home. And you're right. You are on your own. We all are. And we all have to learn it sooner or later. If you have to be alone, though, wouldn't you rather be alone among friends?"
Alone? I looked up, startled. How had she known what I had been thinking back there in the darkness? Grandma Gert's face flushed with embarrassment.
"Oh, dear," she said quickly. "I'm sorry, Amy. Sometimes I forget how strange it can be at first. I don't do it on purpose. But when someone's thoughts are as loud as yours, it can be hard to know the difference."
It took a moment for me to understand what she was saying. "You can read my mind," I said. "Or maybe I just thought it." The old woman nodded.
"Something like that. Please don't be afraid. It's almost always what's right there on the surface. I try not to go too much deeper than that. Not without permission."
I didn't know what to say. And then I realized I didn't have to say anything at all. Anything I could say, Grandma Gert already knew. There was actually something comforting about that. She was staring deep into my eyes.
"Thank you," she said.
At first, I didn't know what she was thanking me for. And then I did. It was for understanding. For not being afraid. Then she gathered herself up, dropped my hand, and squared her shoulders.
"There will be plenty of time to talk about all of this later. First, we need to get you cleaned up."
Her eyes drifted down to my scratched, bruised arms and bloody t-shirt. "Mombi certainly does know how to start a fight." Gert waved her hand, and the tree at the center of the cavern began to transform before my eyes. The roots swirled at my feet. The branches drew themselves down from the ceiling. The trunk began to melt like tar into the ground. When it was done, she and I were standing next to a deep pool where the tree had stood before. Foamy white water bubbled up from somewhere beneath the ground, and steam wafted off the surface. It smelled clean and fresh.
"Go ahead," Gert said, placing a hand on the small of my back and nudging me forward. "It will heal you."
She didn't have to tell me twice. I stepped right into the spring, not even bothering to take my clothes off. I didn't need to. They began to disintegrate as soon as they touched the water. I didn't care that they were gone. And I didn't care that I was naked in front of an old woman I'd just met. The minute the warm, clear water touched my bare skin, I felt my muscles melting as bubbles spun around me. I looked down at myself and watched, astonished, as days' worth of dirt slid right off my body. But I was also surprised to see exactly how hurt I really was. Bruises peppered my arms and legs. Thick red tendrils of blood slipped from a gash across my abdomen that I didn't remember getting in the first place. When I looked up, I saw that Gert was beside me in the water, still fully clothed, her white dress billowing around her. I wasn't sure why the water hadn't affected her clothes the way it had mine. I hadn't even noticed her get in with me. She looked concerned, too, frowning down at my wounds.
"This may hurt, Amy," she said.
"Huh?" I asked, stretching. "No, it feels wonderful."
"Take a deep breath," she said, her tone now serious.
With no further apology, before I'd even had a chance to do as she'd told me, she put her hand on my head and shoved me under the water. The wound on my belly throbbed now with a deep, searing pain. Instinctively, I opened my mouth to scream as I struggled against the old woman's grip. It was no use. Invisible hands grasped me from somewhere deep below the water, holding me in place. Somehow, I knew that all of them belonged to Gert. I was on fire. I had escaped Dorothy, escaped the Tin Woodman and his metal army, only to find someone I trusted, someone who wanted to help me. And it had all been a trick. All she meant to do was kill me. "Why?" I screamed in my head, knowing she'd be able to hear. "Why would you do this?"
"Sometimes only pain can heal," a cold, distant voice answered.
Just when I thought my lungs would burst, just as I felt consciousness beginning to leave me, the hands let go. My body floated up to the surface, where I gasped for air and found my footing on the smooth rocks lining the pool. I spun around and faced Gert angrily. "Why?" I demanded again, this time out loud. "Why would you—"
"Because it was necessary," Gert said shortly, pursing her lips. "I saved your life."
I didn't believe her at first, but my fingers touched smooth skin when I reached for my wound. I looked down. No gaping bloody hole, no invisible sutures, no scar. The wound had healed like it had never happened at all. The bruises were gone, too. My skin looked dewy and softer than it ever had been, peachy pink like all the dead skin had been sloughed off, as if every imperfection healed from the outside in. It didn't matter. She had saved me, okay, fine, but that wasn't the point. The point was that it still felt like a betrayal. Gert had been one thing, and then she had become something else. I didn't understand why. I didn't know if I wanted to.
"You had to trust me," Gert said. Her lips didn't move. "But you also have to learn not to trust anyone. Even me."
She sank slowly into the pool, and then she was gone. By the edge of the water, I saw that a stack of towels and a gorgeous silk robe had been laid out for me. Had Gert put them there when I wasn't paying attention, or had they just appeared by magic? I didn't really care. I wanted to stay in here forever, but I knew that I couldn't. When I felt the water beginning to turn lukewarm, I reluctantly stepped out and dried my newly healed body. I couldn't help thinking that this was all another trick, something to try to lure me into a false sense of security. But my clothes were gone. I couldn't walk around naked. The robe felt soft against my skin. Gert reappeared as soon as I looped the belt around my waist, as if she sensed I was ready to move on to the next part of whatever fate awaited me.
"They're waiting," she announced.
They? I asked, not looking at her. Who's they? I crossed my hands over my chest like a 5-year-old. Gert's face softened. Forgiveness doesn't come easy for you, I see. Sometimes you have to bend so as not to break, dear. You manipulated me, I said. I know it. You used your magic on me to make you think you were my friend.
Maybe I did, and maybe I didn't, Gert said. But if I did, maybe it was for a reason. And if I did, then what's stopping me from doing it again?
I glanced suspiciously at her, and she shrugged. I guess I would have to take that as an apology. I didn't know where we were going or who was waiting for us, but I followed Gert obediently as she led me out of the cavern and through a series of caves. I didn't particularly want to, but I knew by now that I didn't really have a choice. We walked through a room that was entirely empty except for stark silver walls, and as we moved through it, the air changed. It was heavy and humid all of a sudden. Clouds hovered near the ceiling of the cave, spitting down raindrops on our heads. A thought suddenly occurred to me. If these witches could make weather indoors, if they could control it, could they create a tornado? Did they bring me here? I wondered. If we could do that, we would have done it long ago, Gert said curtly. Your arrival in Oz is no coincidence. Someone or something sent for you. But whatever force might have brought you here is beyond even the witch's knowledge. I just ignored her. Gert paused when we reached a new tunnel. She reached up and adjusted the collar of my robe before pulling me into another room that was almost entirely taken up by an enormous table made of what looked like glittering black diamonds, surrounded by rough wooden chairs. Mombi stood at the head of the table, smiling at me, well, wickedly. At her sides were two other people I'd never met before. It wasn't a huge leap to guess that they, too, were witches.
Amy, Mombi greeted me from the other side of the table. I trust you've recovered from our journey. I was very pleased at the gumption you showed back in the dungeons, and we're all happy to have you with us.
My eyes immediately snapped to her left. Standing there was a boy with smooth, olive skin, who looked like he was around my age, maybe a little older. His dark hair stood on end as if he had stuck his fingers in a light socket years ago and hadn't bothered to comb it since. He was cute, sure, but there was something arrogant in the way he looked at me with pale gray eyes. Or maybe not arrogant. Maybe he looked angry. I straightened and stared right back. Who was he? The idea of Gert or Mombi having kids just didn't seem right, and he was a little scary, really. Which was saying a lot given the fact that he was sitting next to Mombi.
She had a nasty slice in her side, Mombi, Gert said, looking her in the eye.
But she didn't much care for the healing process.
Mombi didn't blink.
Tin soldiers. The cell was protected. I had to improvise.
Gert nodded, but I didn't think she believed her. Was she suggesting that Mombi was just testing me out? Standing on Mombi's other side was a curvy, statuesque woman wearing a tight purple wrap dress. A hood concealed her face, but when she pulled it away, my heart skipped a beat and then sank. It was Glinda. Glinda, the not-so-good witch. The one who was besties with Dorothy, who had made the Munchkins her slaves and was using them to mine giant holes all over Oz.
She wasn't wearing perma-smile, but she was smiling at me. She spoke in a sickeningly